Are you fascinated by unsolved mysteries that hit close to home? Sins of the South, three Oklahoma cold cases by victim advocate Raven Rollins, dives into a trio of haunting crimes from around the state. From a deadly New Year's Eve for Shauna Jones and Henrietta, to Daniel Furr in Ada, whose family still questions if they truly found his body, and Sheila DaVinci, whose Maysville house fire was initially ruled accidental but later amended to homicide. Sins of the South is available now in paperback, ebook, and through your favorite library app. Find a retailer at RavenRollins.com. Then check out Sins of the South, three Oklahoma cold cases. Can you help solve a mystery?
You're listening to Sirens, a true crime podcast brought to you by the Sirens Network. This podcast contains explicit content, so listener discretion is advised. The opinions expressed on this podcast are solely the views of the hosts and do not reflect the views of affiliates, associates, or sponsors of this podcast. This is Sirens, a true crime podcast.
They completely evacuated. Rescue workers were not allowed to re-enter the site until confirmation was given that no additional explosives were located. Once they cleared the site, and while this is happening, 9:45 a.m., Governor Frank Keating ordered a state of emergency. He released from duty all Oklahoma City area non-essential state personnel as a safety measure. He straight up drove down to the site, him and Lieutenant Governor Mary Fallon at the time. Both arrived at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and they started like debriefing and situation management and all that stuff. At 10:35 a.m., Regional Director Young for FEMA Dallas had briefed FEMA headquarters in Washington, D.C., and they organized a group of key staff to accompany him to Oklahoma City. So FEMA immediately put the search and rescue, the Urban Search and Rescue Task Force from Phoenix, Arizona, and Sacramento, Arizona, on alert. And only 20 minutes later, activated each of them for deployment to Oklahoma City. So it was only an hour later that FEMA was on its way. The ATF and the DEA joined forces with the FBI, and their respective staff spent the afternoon establishing operation centers and doing field operations. And Weldon Kennedy of the Phoenix, Arizona office of the FBI was assigned special agent in charge. So they were trying to manage this situation that no one ever could have imagined would happen.
We have, a lot of people don't realize that we do have our police and our National Guard. We have military here, tons of military here. Mm-hmm. And all of these people are very well briefed and trained on, like, my brother is on the CERT team, which is like the SWAT team. Like, it's an emergency response team. You know, they have to bring in a mobile makeshift morgue, and they have to put bodies in this refrigerated truck and all this kind of stuff. We are actually prepared for that. It's not normal. It's not run of the mill, but we're not scrambling to figure out what the hell to do. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's because we have earthquakes and wildfires, you know, in California. Then we started having these mass shootings at schools. Then we had mass shootings at concerts and movies. And then all the Gulf and their fun with hurricanes. And, you know, so it's like we have things implemented in place. We have emergency response teams of all kinds for this sort of thing. It's so insanely humbling whenever you see the way that Americans act. Whenever you're actually being an American, you're not a Democrat or a Republican or a Christian or an atheist. You're not black or a cop or this or that or whatever. All the shit that they do to like pit you against each other. When a tragedy occurs, everyone is suddenly just an American. And to watch all these Americans come and help fight for these people and their lives and go through rubble and put themselves in danger for them.
It's from just all over the nation. But and speaking of that, they already had plans to implement, in case something like this happened, for a temporary morgue, and that was almost immediately established at the First Methodist Church in Oklahoma City. At 3:30 p.m., the First Christian Church was established by the state medical examiner's office as the site of the Family Assistance Center, aka the Compassion Center. Immediate family members could go there and wait there to receive accurate briefings directly from the state medical examiner's office on if they found their loved one or not.
I never knew about that.
At the time when they established this Compassion Center, there were still 167 people missing. So.
Oh my God.
Heartbreaking. Center support was provided by many organizations. The Red Cross was there, the Salvation Army, the Oklahoma Funeral Directors Association, and many pastors, chaplains, and mental health professionals throughout the area, state, and even nation showed up. They opened a shelter for those displaced by the explosion because, like I said, almost right next door to this building was an apartment complex. And now those people, for safety reasons, you know, they're being evacuated out of that building and they're displaced. So they set up this center, the Red Cross did. They also activated the National Disaster Services Human Resources Team to administer large-scale disaster assistance to victims of the incident. Feed the Children actually came in and brought them a lot of stuff. The Salvation Army brought a lot of stuff so that they could get food, bottled water, stuff like that. The Oklahoma Restaurant Association, who had just finished their annual conference when the explosion occurred, they quickly established a 24-hour food service operation at the Marriott Convention Center to feed all emergency response workers, which I think is phenomenal. Because those people were out there, they didn't eat, they didn't sleep. There were people that working to the bone trying to, you know, help with search and rescue and all of this stuff. And just the amounts of people that they were treating and like trying to get to hospitals and stuff like that. Like they didn't think about eating.
All day and night they had those work lights out there so that they could just continue because there's the search. You know, the search part of like getting on that big concrete and everything moved out of the way. And like the newspapers, that very famous picture of the fireman carrying that baby, the wounds and the blood and the head. Like normally the media kind of shelters you from that. Like if there's a car accident, there's not going to be a body in the picture. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. It was so massive. And there was so much trauma that we couldn't be protected from it. I'm sitting there as an 8-year-old. I remember every single.
Oh, yeah.
And my mother still has that cutout, that newspaper cutout. It's on our refrigerator. So really? I saw that picture every day of my life. Yes, because it's just it's got a prayer for the first responders. And then that picture is the headliner of it.
My heart.
I know. Yes. And there was no way the media was just, you couldn't get around it. You were seeing bodies. You were seeing blood. You were seeing mangled people with their clothes blown off. Their clothes were blown off.
Yeah.
Like that's insane to me.
There were like just regular people who were volunteering their services to the first responders as well, which included like chiropractic services and massage therapy. They were just coming out like, hey, I know you are working right now. And my husband has this issue too. Like it's work, 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 save these lives. Don't worry about me. And these people were coming in going, you need to sit for a minute. You need to eat. We need to check you out. Like you need to just, can you just take a minute, please? Because they were so focused, which is amazing. And AT&T was actually providing free telephone calls home to anyone who was in the search and rescue task forces from out of state, which is also amazing. Eventually, the Marriott Hotel would house 9 of the 11 search and rescue task forces from out of state. So at 4 p.m., President Clinton announced that he had signed Emergency Declaration FEMA 3115 EMOK. And this declaration permits the federal government to provide emergency assistance to save lives, protect property, public health and safety, and to lessen or avert the threat of further damage. It also authorized 100% federal financial reimbursement for all eligible response missions that performed by local or state government.
Amazing.
The search and rescue task force from Phoenix arrived at about 10:45 p.m. The Sacramento US&R task force arrived at 11 p.m.
Is that not incredible? That's 13 hours from Phoenix to Oklahoma City from the time it happened. They had to have set out like, all right, that's it. We're going to Oklahoma. I say it's such a humbling feeling, Raven. Like, it's so humbling, even though it's not, I would love to say it's not personal, but it was. It was very personal. It was very hurtful. It was very confusing. It was very, it's still hard to talk about. It was very hard to watch and try to understand.
Mm-hmm.
It honestly feels personal. Like they personally came to help you, to save yeah. you. And it had nothing to do with you. It's just your neighbors in a situation that you never, ever want to see.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense.
And they worked to the bone for 17 days straight, which is, I mean, like hardly any breaks, day and night. Search and rescue missions continued for 17 days. They had to go through a mountain of debris, which most of it was deposited at the north face of the Murrah building. And it was removed almost entirely by hand.
Oh my God.
So incredible. These search and rescue teams were, again, moving things with 5-gallon buckets. Fill the bucket, remove it. Fill the bucket, remove it. Because, one, there's a possibility that there are survivors underneath there. But also, there is the possibility that there are bodies. And they wanted to try to respect the families and not let the media get those pictures.
Yeah.
And so doing it by hand, they could kind of control that. And not only that, but the structure was still completely unsturdy. And they wanted to see if they could find anything for evidence while they were doing this. There were so many things that they had to think about when they were doing these search and rescue missions. During that 17-day mission, rescue workers were subjected to high winds, rain, sleet, lightning, hail. I mean, like you were saying, it was moving into tornado season. And the weather is insane here for people who don't live in Oklahoma, who don't know what it's like. The weather has no idea what it wants to do at any given moment. It could change its mind at any given moment. I think there's a quote somewhere that said, and I can't remember who it's by, so I apologize, but it said to try to predict Oklahoma weather is insanity because you just can't. It just changes on a whim. And these people were working through all of that, which is absolutely incredible. And these are people, a lot of them, who had probably never been to Oklahoma before. They're like, what is happening?
Well, you've got from the northwest, you've got the wind coming off the Rockies and it's chilly and it's not as humid. And then you've got the humidity coming up from the Gulf and swirling around. Hence why that's Tornado Alley in the first place.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's incredible what they worked through. And then so shortly after midnight on May 5th, search and rescue operations were determined to be officially complete. It was anticipated at the time that 3 bodies were still in the rubble. They had not accounted for 3 people. And due to believed location and potential safety hazards, the decision was made to leave the remaining bodies in the rubble until after the implosion of the structure. Can you imagine making that kind of call? Because I can't.
No.
They have to set up, like, there's a lot to demolish a building that goes into that. You know, you're also wondering, this might sound horrible, but you're also wondering, are we going to get those bodies out intact? Are we going to be able to send them home to their family? You know, I believe that they had determined that where they thought these people were, because at this time, they knew who was missing and they knew what departments that these people worked in. They had some sort of idea of where they would have been in the building, and they thought that those places were just way too structurally unsound to get to them. And I understand you don't want to put any more lives at risk. So that must have been such a horrible decision to make. I can't imagine that. So on April 26th, the state of Oklahoma requested and received Presidential Major Disaster Declaration FEMA 1048-DROK. And this declaration activated a multitude of recovery and relief programs for victims' families, the injured, small business owners, and public entities that were all impacted by this. The RCC would meet basically on a weekly basis, and to date, they have distributed over $2 million in donated funds to help these people try to get back on their feet, which is pretty awesome. And as soon as the president signed the declaration, the national toll-free teleregistration system was activated for those people. So they could just call in, like immediately get assistance. And the Family Assistance Center, or the Compassion Center, was officially transferred to the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services on May 5th and became known as Project Heartland. That day, when that went into effect, they also had a memorial service for just the rescue and recovery workers, for the victims. Like, they all gathered together and had a memorial service for the victims, like, on their own. That was not, it was closed to the media, it was closed to the public, it was just for them. So they stopped these recovery efforts after 17 days, April 26th. On Tuesday, May 23rd, 7:02 a.m., they demolished the building. The three remaining victims were found where they had predicted that they would have been. They were able to get them to their loved ones. The final three bodies, those of two credit union employees and a customer, they were recovered. This would bring the final death count to 168, including 19 children, and an Oklahoma City nurse who had responded to the incident and was mortally wounded when she was struck in the head with a piece of falling debris. 98 of those who perished were government employees, and there were more than 700 known injuries. There were 388 people, 340 adults, and 48 children from 3 months old to 85 years old in the building at the time of the explosion. And on impact, 163 of those people perished.
McVeigh said that he had no knowledge that the federal offices ran a daycare center on the second floor of the building, and that he might have chosen a different target if he had known about it. Nichols said that he and McVeigh knew there was a daycare center in the building and that they did not care. Well, it says right here, during an interview with Ed Bradley for television news magazine 60 Minutes in 2000, Bradley asked McVeigh for his reaction to the deaths of 19 children. McVeigh stated, "I thought it was terrible that there were children in the building."
I'm going to tell you about a couple of the survivors. Six of those survivors included a group of children from the daycare center. And the only way that they survived is because they had a table near kind of the center of the building where they were near a bathroom. And one of those children was actually in the bathroom at the time. But those other five were sitting at this table. And that's literally the only reason why they survived. One survivor had 40 broken bones from crush injuries. And that included, like, her pelvis was broken. She had crushed feet. Like, she was put into a 5-week coma, to a medically induced coma, to help her get through this because the pain was just absolutely so severe.
Yeah, you shouldn't be awake for that.
Yeah, no. And when she finally came out of it, she had to be taught how to talk again, how to walk again, how to eat again, how to brush her teeth. And she still to this day has compromised lungs. She's still not okay.
Like, some of them died of crushed lungs. Some of them died of a broken neck. Some of them died, you know, there are a lot of different causes of death in that building. Whether they died immediately, 5 minutes later, 20 minutes later, 4 days later, it doesn't fucking matter. There's all kinds of different kinds.
So another victim had plaster from the building that when the blast went off, it came off of the building and it was like shoved up under her skin in a lot of places.
Oh my God.
That she had to have, they had to remove it surgically. She also had face and neck injuries. She had one ear that was cut in half, and there was like a crap ton of shrapnel that was taken from her back. In total, she had about 4 feet of stitches done. 4 feet of stitches. Only 3 people were extracted alive after the first 5 hours following the explosion. There were up to 50,000 people in the Oklahoma City area that reportedly suffered PTSD-related symptoms in the aftermath.
I'm not entirely convinced that I don't have PTSD from it.
I know. Well, that's why I say reportedly.
I watched it every freaking day. Like, that's what my grandmother, there was a television in the kitchen, and while she would make dinner, you know, the TV would be on. While we had dinner, we'd watch the news, and it's just like, that's all I saw for a month.
Like, when they did the demolition, it took them several days to haul all that out of there. And there was like 800 tons of debris just from the site itself. That's so much. Like, this was a 9-story building. But yeah, I can't imagine living in Oklahoma City where you have to see this every day. I can definitely see why there would be people with PTSD. And there's probably, you're right, there's probably way more than 50,000. But that's just, you know, like reported to medical personnel or whatever, that 50,000. The General Services Administration immediately sought to replace the facility. Like, they wanted to rebuild on top of it immediately. And a lot of other people were like, no, you can't. You have to, that's like a sacred site now, so.
Yeah, that's hollow, almost like hollowed ground. Like, it's, no.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
So they decided to get a new space, and I want to say the new one was like 185,000 square feet, designed by Ross Barney Architects of Chicago, Illinois, and constructed on a 2-city block site, 1 block north and west of where the former building was standing. So the new building's design included blast-resistant glazing. Do you blame them?
Right.
The structural design also is supposed to resist progressive collapse. I'm not an architect. I don't know anything about any of that. But to me, that sounds like it's bomb-proof, right?
Hopefully. As close to it as you could get.
Yeah. So throughout all of the event of the bombing, ODCEM, Emergency Management, utilized a full-time staff of about 25, like 24-hour operations, people who were there 24 hours. And since that time, 6 of those 25 have left the department. Like we were talking about with the Girl Scout murders.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
How a bunch of the FBI agents after that, like, were like, I'm out, I'm done, I can't do this anymore. We kind of had that situation as well, which is completely understandable. Timothy McVeigh sits in jail for 2 days. McVeigh is finally identified as the subject of the nationwide manhunt. He claims that all of these mistakes that, like I was saying, like, why would you use your real name here and not there? He claims that all of those were not mistakes at all, or oversights, but they were done on purpose to ensure that if it came down to him being killed during apprehension or being accidentally blown up by the bomb itself, he would be able to be identified and be known as the OKC bomber. He had anticipated suicide by cop. He says, quote, I, in fact, may be, in a sense, a groundbreaker for suicide by cop. And the reason why I call myself a groundbreaker is because I knew all of this before it happened. I knew that my objective was state-assisted suicide, And when it happens, in your face, motherfucker. In other words, I'm manipulating the system for my own gain. If you put it on a scoreboard, it's 168-1. I sit here today content that there's no way that they can beat me. He's literally sitting here putting these deaths on a scoreboard, saying, I killed 168 people and you're only going to kill one, so I win.
Yeah, because that's better. That makes sense.
So he was arraigned, like, for the crimes that he was pulled over for. He was actually about to get out of jail when they identified him as the Oklahoma City bomber.
He was, like literally about to walk out the door, and someone slips the judge a note, like, hey, yo, don't let him go anywhere.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. He would have been in the wind. Like, I don't know if they would have been able to find him if they had let him go, honestly.
Oh, my God, I know.
Eventually, maybe, but it would have taken a while. There would have been, like, this massive manhunt. Anyway, when investigators initially interviewed him, they showed him pictures of the carnage to try to get him to talk. He said, quote, they showed me pictures of dead babies and tried to get me to talk to make me feel bad or something, but it didn't work. I kept a straight face and I said I wanted an attorney, unquote.
But he bounces back and forth like he's sorry for the people he's killed, and then he's proud of the people he's killed, and then he's proud of what's happening in his rearview mirror, and then he's remorseful that there's children involved, and then he's like, oh, well, children die every day. Does it just change according to who you're talking to or what day of the week it is or if it's after 2 p.m. or what?
I really don't know.
I don't either.
I will say that when they looked at his driver's license, because they wanted an address on him to see if he had any other bomb-making equipment in his home. The address on his driver's license was actually the address for Decker, Michigan, which was James Nichols' home, who was the brother of Terry Nichols. So on his driver's license, it wasn't even, like, I guess that's just where he had claimed to be living at the time. Agents, of course, went to that address, to the home of James Nichols. And Terry Nichols at the time was not living there with James anymore. He was living in Harrington, Kansas. Because police believed both of these men were involved, they got a search warrant. In Terry's home, they found a receipt for 2,000 pounds of fertilizer. They also found a calling card in the name of Daryl Bridges, who shared the same address in Decker, Michigan. So they traced calls back and forth and found a trail of calls placed to acquire materials for the bomb building. That's when they also found out about Michael Fortier. That same afternoon, James and Terry Nichols were arrested. Terry cooperated with the authorities, like, almost immediately. And then Michael Fortier was arrested as well. On August 10th, 1995, Timothy McVeigh was indicted on 11 federal counts, including conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction, use of a weapon of mass destruction, destruction with the use of explosives, and 8 counts of first-degree murder. Now, I know what you're thinking. What about, like, why are we not hearing 168, right? Mm-hmm. So here's how it goes. They wanted to charge him federally. Deaths that were not federal agents were separated, and those were categorized under the Oklahoma Court District. So they basically extracted the federal employees that he killed, and that's what the federal courts charged him with. So basically, Oklahoma is sitting back waiting to see what happens with the federal trial, and then we'll determine if they want to charge him in their courts. On February 20th, 1996, the court granted a change of venue and ordered that the case be transferred from Oklahoma City to the U.S. District Court in Denver, Colorado, like the federal court. The trial of Timothy McVeigh, April 24th, 1997, 2 years after the bombing. The U.S. Department of Justice had brought federal charges against him for causing the deaths of 8 federal officers, leading to a possible death penalty. They could not bring charges against McVeigh for the remaining 160 murders in federal court because those deaths fell under the jurisdiction of the state of Oklahoma. McVeigh instructed his lawyers to use a necessity defense. I don't know if you know what a necessity defense is, but it basically means he wanted them to say that he was in immediate danger and had to defend himself against the government. And he proclaimed that that's what it was, that it was in self-defense, that he was under attack by the government. But his attorney was like, okay, well, we have to basically be able to prove imminent danger from the government, and we cannot do that in this case. He also wanted them, his lawyers, to present the jury with the controversial video Waco, the Big Lie, which is a conspiracy theory video of what happened at Waco. He wanted them to present that to the jury. And his lawyers were like, no to that as well. Michael Fortier testified against him in his trial. It was pretty damning. And so was Terry Nichols' testimony. They both just kind of said exactly what happened. They didn't try to cover anything up. They let it all out there. Michael Fortier even said he felt really guilty about not warning anyone about the plans. He said, for the most part, he wasn't sure that he would go through with it. And by the way, McVeigh said nothing during this trial. I'm pretty sure that he didn't even get on the stand to defend himself, because he has absolutely no quotes. Everywhere that I have seen says he said nothing until like the sentencing hearing or something like that. I'll get to it. But he said nothing during the trial. So closing arguments were made on May 29th, 1997. The district court charged the jury on May 30th, 1997. On June 2nd, after 4 days of deliberation, the jury returned guilty verdicts on all 11 counts charged in the indictment. After the verdict, McVeigh tried to calm his mother by saying, "Think of it this way. When I was in the army, you didn't see me for years. Think of me that way now, like I'm away in the army again on an assignment for the military." The penalty phase of the trial commenced on June 4th, 97, and concluded with summations and jury instructions on June 12th. And on June 13th, the jury deliberated for 2 days before returning special findings recommending that McVeigh be sentenced to death. Of course, his attorneys appealed almost immediately. On August 14th, 1997, and they sentenced McVeigh to death on all 11 counts. Before the sentence was formally pronounced by Judge Match, McVeigh addressed the court. This is the first and only time that he said anything during sentencing. Quote, "I wish to use the words of Justice Brandis dissenting in Olmstead to speak for me." He wrote, "Our government is the potent, the omnipresent teacher. For good or for ill, it teaches the whole people by its example. That's all I have to say." Unquote.
He's basically just saying, like, you need to watch the way you treat your people, because you're leading by example, like a parent.
Because McVeigh was convicted and sentenced to death, the state of Oklahoma did not file murder charges against him for the other 160 deaths. Yeah, his execution would be the first in 38 years within the federal prison system. Anyway, after his trial, there was a man, Lou Michel, who one of the only people who ever got his confessions on tape. And they did like a series. There's like boxes of tapes, but they were never heard or anything. I believe he used it to write that book you mentioned earlier, the official autobiography or whatever.
Yeah.
But for a long while, no one ever heard these tapes. I listened to the tapes and I have some information from them, basically all quotes. So in those tapes, he said that he did that, the bombing, for the greater good. That the Turner Diaries book taught him all he needed, along with his military background and his quote unquote friends, to make an effective bomb. He just amplified the recipe by using more volatile fuel, because he used racing fuel when he did it. He chose the date, April 19th, for the bombing, not only for the anniversary of the Waco fire, but the anniversary of the shot heard around the world, which he's referring to 1777, which was the start of the Revolutionary War. He said that he, quote, didn't love his parents, that the only man he ever loved was his grandfather, Ed, which is kind of sad because didn't you say that he had like a makeshift second set of parents?
Yeah, their names were Liz and Jack McDermott. But I mean, he wrote them all the way up until his death. They wrote him in prison. Like, he's still that sweet kid down the block.
His grandfather, Ed, lived like, I want to say like 5 blocks away from him. And he would go down there and visit him all the time. But I mean, yeah, again, we're talking about a completely different person because he's got these two, he's like two-faced. He's got these two sides. This is another one of his quotes. This one gets to me. The rules of engagement, if not written down, are defined by the actions of an aggressor. What rules of engagement would you interpret in examining Waco? Kids are fair game. Women are fair game. With Oklahoma City being a counterattack, I was only fighting by the rules of engagement that were introduced by the aggressor. Waco started this war. Hopefully Oklahoma would end it. End quote. He also said that he had no problem sleeping in the truck that held the bomb on the way to the bombing location because he had to cross state lines. And he was driving it from the Junction City, Kansas, all the way to Oklahoma City. And he would have to pull over at times, you know, and like sleep on the way there. According to him, he had no problem sleeping right next to that bomb. He said he was, quote unquote, at peace. Trying to like interpret or take in what this man was thinking is literally shutting my brain down.
Well, like, he couldn't even determine what he was thinking. He's sad about it. He's remorseful. He's not sad. It happens every day. Like, these are the roller coasters of Timothy McVeigh's head.
Of the bombing casualties, he said, quote, people die every day. We have plane crashes where 100 to 200 people die, and those are unexpected losses. We have to accept it and move on. I have no problem looking at the victims and saying, you aren't the first mother to lose a kid. You're not the first grandmother to lose a grandson. Get over it. End quote.
Okay. Well, you take a minute to catch your breath. You took human lives. The airplane is a tragic accident. 168 people that you took on purpose, had a plan, spent money, drove hours and hours to do this. That's not the same.
No.
At all. That is on purpose. He's out of touch with reality, terribly.
And he can't see what such a hypocrite he is. And that's what gets me, is that how can you not see how what you have done is the exact same thing that you have persecuted the government over doing at Waco? It's the exact same thing.
You can't tell me that an accident and retaliation are the same level of... like tragic death.
And for you to say, get over it.
If someone's life was taken because of an accident, that's hard to process. If someone's life is taken because of malice and spite.
And retaliation.
It's childish. He had written letters to his sister, one stating something big was going to happen. She, whenever they went to talk to her, she was caught burning a stack of papers in a barbecue grill.
What?
They thought she might have known it was going to happen, but she was granted immunity in exchange for cooperating with the prosecution as a hostile witness.
Wow. I mean, I know that would have to be a really, really, really hard thing for a family member to have done something like this.
I don't know either.
And then to have to sit on the stand and testify against them, to have to be on the stand and look them in the eyes and speak your truth. And it is the truth, but, you know, that's not their truth. That's not the defendant's truth.
Yeah, you can tell he was never wrong.
I mean, it's just got to be really hard.
Yeah.
So on July 13th, 1999, Timothy McVeigh was transferred to the death row unit in Terre Haute, Indiana. was a federal unit. And on July 11th, which was 2 days later, he was brought to the death chamber. When asked what he was feeling on the gurney, he said contentment and peace. People from all over the world congregated outside the prison to see it through and to celebrate his death. Do you remember, like, I don't know if you've seen any footage of the execution of Ted Bundy.
Oh, God, yeah. They were like, it was like cheerleaders for the Beatles outside.
It was exactly like that for McVeigh's execution. There were people outside that had, that were making t-shirts. There were people that were holding up signs, and there were people who were like celebrating and like, which I get it. I get it. But
I don't think the decent thing to do is to celebrate a death.
Like, right there with you.
I think you got what you deserved. We've brought up killing him 168 times.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to stand there and chant and, you know, scream and woo-hoo and say rude things about it. Like,
exactly.
We're sitting here talking about how answering for a death with other deaths is not right.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, talking about how we want to kill him 168 times. You're no longer an innocent person.
Yeah.
You have killed 168 innocent people.
Oh, yeah.
So am I going to woo-hoo and be happy about it? No, it's sad. It's tragic that your life came to this because you fought for my freedom.
Oh, yeah. And how many freaking medals did you get? Like, you were a war hero.
A bronze star.
Yeah.
You're the kind of person that I would shake hands with and respect.
Absolutely. And it came to this.
I don't understand that.
Mm-hmm. So McVeigh invited Kate McCulley and Lou Michel, which was the man who recorded his confession tapes, to witness his execution. Kate reports that he looked at her and mouthed the words, "It's okay," just before. And at 7:14 a.m., June 11th, 2001, he was executed by lethal injection. More than 200 survivors and the victims' families witnessed the execution on closed circuit television. So they kind of like had this live television feed going that was just for them. He was 33 years old when he was executed, and he made no last statements. He had no final words.
Oh my God.
His ashes were spread in an undisclosed location.
Look at the amount of good or the amount of damage you can do in that many years.
On May 26th, 2004, Terry Nichols was convicted of 161 counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to 161 consecutive life sentences without parole in the federal Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. Michael Fortier was sentenced to 12 years in prison for failing to warn authorities about the impending attack. And in 2006, after serving 10 and a half years, Fortier was released for good behavior. He is now in the Witness Protection Program under a new identity.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so you could know him. I could know him.
I know. No.
Yeah. Oh. Let's talk about the memorial where the building stood. Now there is a memorial museum on top of those grounds. Like we were saying earlier, there are a couple walls that are still standing. They kind of built this museum and memorial area on top of this. So within the walls of the memorial museum, there are artifacts, interactive displays, and videos that lend themselves to a self-guided tour that visitors can take to learn about the events of the day, the people affected, the investigation, and the overall resiliency of hope. Adjacent to the museum is the outdoor symbolic memorial. Where the Murrah Building once stood are now symbolic elements honoring all who were touched directly or indirectly by the bombing, including the field of empty chairs, the survivor tree or the hope tree, survivor wall, reflecting pool, rescuers orchard, and the children's area, and also the gate of time. And the original flagpole is still in use. So when you enter the memorial grounds, visitors pass through one of two immense gates, and they have these words: "We come here to remember those who were killed, those who survived, and those changed forever. May all who leave here know the impact of violence. May this memorial offer comfort, strength, peace, hope, and serenity." The Eastern Gate, which has 901 on it, represents the last minute of innocence and a perceived sense of security for Oklahoma City, the state of Oklahoma, and the United States. The Western Gate, which has 903 on it, is the minute after the attack. It's a tribute to the human spirit and our ability for resilience in the face of tragedy, adversity, and fear. These gates symbolically frame the memorial in the minute of 902, a minute of change, devastation, the minute of the explosion. After the bombing, we were able to come together both as a community and as a country during the rescue, rebuilding, and healing process. And in between those two gates is the reflecting pool. The pool reflects all that has changed as a result of the attack. Symbolically, it represents the limitless impact of the event. Our own reflection in the pool leads us to contemplate how different the world we live in today is from that of 1995. The pool sits where Northwest 5th Street once ran. It's the same street that McVeigh drove down to access the front of the building and parallel parked the Ryder truck containing the explosives on the north side of the building. In respect for those lives lost, the street was closed forever. You also have the memorial fence, which... that's the one that you were talking about earlier that was like almost immediately erected. It was limited to like a 20 block area, I think, that was affected by the blast. And the memorial fence protected the community from that dangerous area. And it was like littered with these notes and letters and teddy bears and all of these flowers, all of these things. And it became this spontaneous memorial. Individuals left items that helped them to begin their healing process or that might help others to begin their healing process. In the years since the bombing, over 60,000 items have been removed from the fence and placed in the archives of the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum. Items are still being left in honor and memory of this event, as well as for subsequent tragic events. The Oklahoma City National Memorial has evolved as a place of healing and memory for more than just the Oklahoma City bombing. You also have the new Survivor Wall, which is found at the east end of the Field of Empty Chairs, and it holds the name of over 600 individuals who survived the attack. Survivors include those who were in a one-block radius surrounding the building. Those names are inscribed on four granite panels that were originally located in the lobby of the building itself. And the panels hang on one of two original walls remaining from the Murrah building. You can also see the Rescuer's Orchard surrounds the Survivor Tree, or the Tree of Hope. And it represents over, I believe, 12,000 rescue workers that participated in the rescue effort. There are three different species of trees honoring the men, women, and the rescue dogs who gave selflessly in the aftermath of bombing. The Eastern Redbuds, the smaller trees nearest the Survivor Tree, represent the Oklahoma responders. For Oklahomans, the choice was easy because the Redbud is the state tree. The other trees that make up the orchard, there's the Chinese pistache and Emmer maple. Those are not native to Oklahoma. These trees represent the rescuers that came from other states across the nation to serve in a time of need. Together, the trees are fruit and flower bearing, which represents the fruits of the rescuers' labor. In the middle of those trees, you have the Survivor Tree. It is a 100-year-old American elm that was actually there on the day of the blast.
Amazing.
It's known as the Survivor Tree because this elm is our most famous survivor. Across the street from the former building, the Murrah Building, in 95, the tree stood in a gravel parking lot. Standing between the Murrah Building and the Journal Record Building, there was nothing to shield the tree from the explosion. Severely damaged, the tree was not expected to survive. However, the tree was not a complete loss, and signs of life were soon discovered, still standing in the exact same location 25 years later. The tree became a symbol of the community and the nation's resilience. Like the survivor tree, Oklahoma and the United States suffered greatly, yet rebounded. I'm like having a really hard time here. The field of empty chairs lies within the footprint of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. 168 empty chairs, each etched with the name of a victim, stand as a reminder of the innocent lives that were lost. The emptiness of the chair expresses a sense of absence. The five Western chairs, separated from the larger group, represent those not inside the building, but who lost their lives as a direct result. The other 163 chairs are arranged in a pattern of 9 rows, according to the floors of the building. Each person's chair is then listed in alphabetical order, according to the agency in which they worked or were visiting. The glass base of the chair, which is gorgeous at night, illuminates.
So pretty at night.
So pretty. And it emphasizes those individuals' names. The light delivers comfort from and eliminates the fear of the darkness. As a unit, the empty chairs are arranged to represent the damage done to the building, with the highest concentration of chairs near the center of the footprint to symbolically fill in the damage done to the building by the bomb. And as you look over the field, you will notice 2 sizes of chairs. The large chairs represent the adults, and the smaller chairs represent the 19 children whose lives were taken.
There's going to be a lot of you people out there who have never seen this, and maybe have never even seen the damage, the building. Like, you don't, you know, you're not familiar with it. The building is, whenever we talk about the chairs and we talk about the reflection pool and the huge monuments at each end with the time stamped on them, you think that it would be a grave feeling. You'd think that it would be almost haunting.
It's serene.
Seeing the building is haunting. It's terrible. It does not look like hope. But this is, like she said, it's serene. It's comforting almost. And it's almost like a strengthening thing.
How I imagine it is, like, if you imagine monks on the top of a mountain sitting in peace and silence and reflection, that's how I would describe this place. The last area is the children's area. It's nestled in the rescuer's orchard, and it's a reminder of the important role children play from all across the United States and how they played this role in the rescue effort. They sent to those so intimately involved gifts of hope and encouragement in the form of cards, letters, teddy bears, tiles. Though the gifts were a small gesture, the children's area now stands in remembrance of the power of their efforts. Today, a small wall carved with an assortment of tiles designed by children from across the country stand along the children's area. Chalkboards laid out on the ground in the shape of oversized cards and letters are there to encourage children of all ages to leave their own messages of hope and comfort.
In our library, there was a claw-footed bathtub. And if you read X amount of books, or if you read the book you were supposed to read that week, or, you know, you have these special points in class, you got to lay in that claw-footed bathtub during library time. There's tons of pillows and stuff in there. And you could just lay in the claw-footed bathtub all alone and read your book in peace. And it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And they took that bathtub and they put it out in front of the office. And every single kid brought 168 pennies. And we dumped it into that bathtub.
Oh, my heart.
We made like huge cards and banners and rolled them up and sent them, you know, with everything. Like, we're just constantly sending thank yous and all kinds. You know, it's just,
yeah,
it's to hear that they nestled that into, what did they call it? The corn, the orchard?
The rescuer's orchard.
Yeah, the rescuer's orchard. Like, I never really thought about perpetuating comfort and support. When all these people show up from all over America to help your state,
mm-hmm.
whenever yeah. I was saying that it's humbling, it's a sign of everything is not okay, but it's going to be okay. And these people are here to do everything they can to help it be as okay as it possibly can be.
Right.
You're not just left alone to your own defenses. And Arizona's like, well, what if something happens over here? We're just going to stay home, you know, just in case. No, these people dropped everything and came to hold us up when we were falling apart.
Yeah.
And so to see, like, as a child, that's what it looked like. Because every little boy that you know wants to be a fireman when they grow up, you know, and you see these firemen, all these men being absolute heroes. And you see comfort in that. You see a person you can trust. You see a person that saves a life. And so then the fact that not only is the image of them comforting you, to think that all that stuff that you send them and pray for them and everything that you do with them and you're in the front of your mind, I imagine that was comforting too. And I never really thought about it because I wasn't an adult when this happened. Yeah. And so for other people, like, I just never really thought about what it must have been like for them to know that everyone, you know, was just had them in their hearts constantly.
Yeah.
That's a new aspect for me.
Yeah. I mean, you think about times like, you know, what's happening outside in the world today, but you can really take a look around the world in times like that. And in times like these, where you see the helpers, like you were saying, you can see people helping. The Oklahoma City bombing still represents the largest domestic terrorist incident within the United States to date.
You've reached the end of our episode. All suspects are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Catch more next time on the Sirens Podcast.